10. Conclusion. They would reconstruct society on an imaginary plan, much like the astronomers for their own calculation would make over the system of the universe. Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, On the Utopian Socialists. Yet a man who uses an imaginary map, thinking that it is a true one, is likely to be worse off than someone with no map at all, for he will fail to inquire, whenever he can, to observe every detail on his way, and to search continuously with all his senses and all his intelligence for indications of where he should go. E.F. Schumacher, Small is Beautiful. The great high modernist episodes that we have examined qualify as tragedies in at least two respects. First, the visionary intellectuals and planners behind them were guilty of hubris, of forgetting that they were mortals and acting as if they were gods. Second, their actions, far from being cynical grabs for power and wealth, were animated by a genuine desire to improve the human condition, a desire with a fatal flaw. That these tragedies could be so intimately associated with optimistic views of progress and rational order is in itself a reason for a searching diagnosis. Another reason lies in the completely ecumenical character of the high modernist faith. We encounter it in various guises in colonial development schemes, planned urban centers in both the East and the West, collectivized farms, the large development plans of the World Bank, the resettlement of nomadic populations, and the management of workers on factory floors. If such schemes have typically taken their most destructive human and natural toll in the states of the former socialist bloc and in revolutionary third world settings, that is surely because their authoritarian state power, unimpeded by representative institutions, could nullify resistance and push ahead. The ideas behind them, however, on which their legitimacy and appeal depended, were thoroughly Western. Order and harmony that once seemed the function of a unitary God had been replaced by a similar faith in the idea of progress vouchsafed by scientists, engineers, and planners. Their power, it is worth remembering, was least contested at those moments when other forms of coordination had failed or seemed utterly inadequate to the great tasks at hand. In times of war, revolution, economic collapse, or newly won independence. The plans that they hatched bore a family resemblance to the schemes of legibility and standardization devised by the absolutist kings of the 17th and 18th centuries. What was wholly new, however, was the magnitude of both the plans for the wholesale transformation of society and the instruments of statecraft. Censuses, cadastral maps, identity cards, statistical bureaus, schools, mass media, internal security apparatuses, that could take them farther along this road than any 17th-century monarch would have dreamed. Thus it has happened that so many of the 20th century's political tragedies have flown the banner of progress, emancipation, and reform. We have examined in considerable detail how these schemes have failed their intended beneficiaries. If I were asked to condense the reasons behind these failures into a single sentence, I would say that the progenitors of such plans regarded themselves as far smarter and far-seeing than they really were, and, at the same time, regarded their subjects as far more stupid and incompetent than they really were. The remainder of this chapter is devoted to expanding on this cursory judgment and advancing a few modest lessons. It's ignorance, stupid. The mistake of our ancestors was to think that they were the last number, but since numbers are infinite, they could not be the last number. Eugene Zamyatin, We. The maxim that serves as the heading for this section is not simply suitable for bumper stickers mimicking the insider slogan of Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign, "It's the economy, stupid." It is meant to call attention to how routinely planners ignore the radical contingency of the future, how rare it is to encounter advice about the future which begins from a premise of incomplete knowledge. One small exception, a circular on nutrition published by the health clinic at Yale University where I teach, will underscore its rarity. Normally, such circulars explain the major food groups, vitamins, and minerals known to be essential for balanced nutrition and advise a diet based on these categories. This circular, however, noted that many new essential elements of proper nutrition had been discovered in the past 2 decades and that many more elements will presumably be identified by researchers in the decades ahead. Therefore, on the basis of what they did not know, the writers of this piece recommended that one's diet be as varied as possible, on the prudent assumption that it would contain many of these yet unidentified essentials. Social and historical analyses have, almost inevitably, the effect of diminishing the contingency of human affairs. A historical event or state of affairs simply is the way it is, often appearing determined and necessary, when in fact it might easily have turned out to be otherwise. Even a probabilistic social science, however careful it may be about establishing ranges of outcomes, is apt to treat these probabilities, for the sake of analysis, as solid facts. When it comes to betting on the future, the contingency is obvious, but so is the capacity of human actors to influence this contingency and help to shape the future. And in those cases where the bettors thought that they knew the shape of the future by virtue of their grasp of historical laws of progress or scientific truth, whatever awareness they retained of the contingency seemed to dissolve before their faith. And yet each of these schemes, as might also have been predicted, was largely undone by a host of contingencies beyond the planner's grasp. The scope and comprehensiveness of their plans were such that they would have had indeterminate outcomes, even if their historical laws and the attendant specification of variables and calculations had been correct. Their temporal ambitions meant that, although they might, with some confidence, guess the immediate consequences of their moves, no one could specify, let alone calculate, the second or third order consequences or their interaction effects. The wild cards in their deck, however, were the human and natural events outside their models. Droughts, wars, revolts, epidemics, interest rates, world consumer prices, oil embargoes. They could, and did, of course, attempt to adjust and improvise in the face of these contingencies. But the magnitude of their initial intervention was so great that many of their missteps could not be righted. Stephen Marglin has put their problem succinctly. If the only certainty about the future is that the future is uncertain, if the only sure thing is that we are in for surprises, then no amount of planning, no amount of prescription can deal with the contingencies that the future will reveal. There is a curiously resounding unanimity on this point and on no others between such right-wing critics of the command economy as Friedrich Hayek and such left-wing critics of communist authoritarianism as Prince Peter Kropotkin, who declared, "It is impossible to legislate for the future." Both had a great deal of respect for the diversity of human actions and the insurmountable difficulties in successfully coordinating millions of transactions. In a blistering critique of failed development paradigms, Albert Hirschman made a comparable case calling for a little more reverence for life, a little less straitjacketing of the future, a little more allowance for the unexpected, and a little less wishful thinking. One might, on the basis of experience, derive a few rules of thumb that, if observed, could make development planning less prone to disaster. While my main goal is hardly a point-by-point reform of development practice, such rules would surely include something along the following lines. Take small steps. In an experimental approach to social change, presume that we cannot know the consequences of our interventions in advance. Given this postulate of ignorance, prefer wherever possible to take a small step, stand back, observe, and then plan the next small move. As the biologist J.B.S. Haldane metaphorically described the advantages of smallness, you can drop a mouse down a 1,000-yard mineshaft, and on arriving at the bottom, it gets a slight shock and walks away. A rat is killed, a man broken, a horse splashes. Favor reversibility. Prefer interventions that can easily be undone if they turn out to be mistakes. Irreversible interventions have irreversible consequences. Interventions into ecosystems require particular care in this respect, given our great ignorance about how they interact. Aldo Leopold captured the spirit of caution required. The first rule of intelligent tinkering is to keep all the parts. Plan on surprises. Choose plans that allow the largest accommodation to the unforeseen. In agricultural schemes, this may mean choosing and preparing land so that it can grow any of several crops. In planning housing, it would mean designing in flexibility for accommodating changes in family structures or living styles. In a factory, it may mean selecting a location, layout, or piece of machinery that allows for new processes, materials, or product lines down the road. Plan on human inventiveness. Always plan under the assumption that those who become involved in the project later will have or will develop the experience and insight to improve on the design. Planning for abstract citizens. The power and precision of high modernist schemes depended not only on bracketing contingency, but also on standardizing the subjects of development. Some standardization was implicit even in the noblest goals of the planners. The great majority of them were strongly committed to a more egalitarian society, to meeting the basic needs of its citizens, especially the working class, and to making the amenities of a modern society available to all. Let us pause, however, to consider the kind of human subject for whom all these benefits were being provided. This subject was singularly abstract. Figures as diverse as Le Corbusier, Walter Rathenau, the collectivizers of the Soviet Union, and even Julius Nyerere, for all his rhetorical attention to African traditions, were planning for generic subjects who needed so many square feet of housing space, acres of farmland, liters of clean water and units of transportation, and so much food, fresh air, and recreational space. Standardized citizens were uniform in their needs and even interchangeable. What is striking, of course, is that such subjects, like the unmarked citizens of liberal theory, have, for the purposes of the planning exercise, no gender, no tastes, no history, no values, no opinions or original ideas, no traditions, and no distinctive personalities to contribute to the enterprise. They have none of the particular, situated, and contextual attributes that one would expect of any population, and that we, as a matter of course, always attribute to elites. The lack of context and particularity is not an oversight. It is the necessary first premise of any large-scale planning exercise. To the degree that the subjects can be treated as standardized units, the power of resolution in the planning exercise is enhanced. Questions posed within these strict confines can have definitive, quantitative answers. The same logic applies to the transformation of the natural world. Questions about the volume of commercial wood or the yield of wheat in bushels permit more precise calculations than questions about, say, the quality of the soil, the versatility and taste of the grain, or the well-being of the community. The discipline of economics achieves its formidable resolving power by transforming what might otherwise be considered qualitative matters into quantitative issues with a single metric and, as it were, a bottom line, profit or loss. Providing one understands the heroic assumptions required to achieve this precision and the questions that it cannot answer, the single metric is an invaluable tool. Problems arise only when it becomes hegemonic. What is perhaps most striking about high modernist schemes, despite their quite genuine egalitarian and often socialist impulses, is how little confidence they repose in the skills, intelligence, and experience of ordinary people. This is clear enough in the Taylorist factory, where the logic of work organization is to reduce the factory hand's contribution to a series of repetitive, if practiced, movements, operations as machine-like as possible. But it is also clear in collectivized farms, Ujamaa villages, and planned cities, where the movements of the populace have been to a large degree inscribed in the designs of these communities. If Nyerere's aspirations for cooperative state farming were frustrated, it was not because the plans had failed to integrate a scheme of cooperative labor. The more ambitious and meticulous the plan, the less is left, theoretically, to chance and to local initiative and experience. stripping reality to its essentials. The quantitative technologies used to investigate social and economic life work best if the world they aim to describe can be remade in their image. Theodore M. Porter, Trust in Numbers. If the facts, that is, the behavior of living human beings, are recalcitrant to such an experiment, the experimenter becomes annoyed and tries to alter the facts to fit the theory, which, in practice, means a kind of vivisection of societies until they become what the theory originally declared that the experiment should have caused them to be. Isaiah Berlin, On Political Judgment. The clarity of the high modernist optic is due to its resolute singularity. Its simplifying fiction is that, for any activity or process that comes under its scrutiny, there is only one thing going on. In the scientific forest, there is only commercial wood being grown. In the planned city, there is only the efficient movement of goods and people. In the housing estate, there is only the effective delivery of shelter, heat, sewage, and water. In the planned hospital, there is only the swift provision of professional medical services. And yet both we and the planners know that each of these sites is the intersection of a host of interconnected activities that defy such simple descriptions. Even something as apparently monofunctional as a road from A to B can at the same time function as a site for leisure, social intercourse, exciting diversions, and enjoying the view between A and B. For any such site, it is helpful to imagine two different maps of activity. In the case of a planned urban neighborhood, the first map consists of a representation of the streets and buildings, tracing the routes that the planners have provided for the movements between workplaces and residences, the delivery of goods, access to shopping, and so on. The second map consists of tracings, as in a time-lapse photograph, of all the unplanned movements: pushing a baby carriage, window shopping, strolling, going to see a friend, playing hopscotch on the sidewalk, walking the dog, watching the passing scene, taking shortcuts between work and home, and so on. This second map, far more complex than the first, reveals very different patterns of circulation. The older the neighborhood, the more likely that the second map will have nearly superseded the first, in roughly the same way that planned suburban Levitt towns have, after 50 years, become thoroughly different settings from what their designers envisioned. If our inquiry has taught us anything, it is that the first map, taken alone, is misrepresentative and indeed non-sustainable. A same-age monocropped forest with all the debris cleared is in the long run an ecological disaster. No Taylorist factory can sustain production without the unplanned improvisations of an experienced workforce. Planned Brasilia is, in a thousand ways, underwritten by unplanned Brasilia. Without at least some of the diversity identified by Jacobs, a stripped-down public housing project, like Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis or Cabrini-Green in Chicago, will fail its residents. Even for the limited purposes of a myopic plan, commercial timber, factory output, the one-dimensional map will simply not do. As with industrial agriculture and its dependency on land races, the first map is possible only because of processes lying outside its parameters, which it ignores at its peril. Our inquiry has also taught us that such maps of legibility and control, especially when they are backed by an authoritarian state, do partly succeed in shaping the natural and social environment after their image. To the degree that such thin maps do manage to impress themselves on social life, what kind of people do they foster? Here I would argue that just as the monocropped same-age forest represents an impoverished and unsustainable ecosystem, so the high modernist urban complex represents an impoverished and unsustainable social system. Human resistance to the more severe forms of social straitjacketing prevents monotonic schemes of centralized rationality from ever being realized. Had they been realized in their austere forms, they would have represented a very bleak human prospect. One of Le Corbusier's plans, for example, called for the segregation of factory workers and their families in barracks along the major transportation arteries. It was a theoretically efficient solution to transportation and production problems. If it had been imposed, the result would have been a dispiriting environment of regimented work and residence without any of the animation of town life. This plan had all the charm of a Taylorist scheme where, using a comparable logic, the efficient organization of work was achieved by confining the workers' movements to a few repetitive gestures. The cookie-cutter design principles behind the layout of the Soviet collective farm, the Ujamaa village, or the Ethiopian resettlement betray the same narrowness of vision. They were designed, above all, to facilitate the central administration of production and the control of public life. Almost all strictly functional, single-purpose institutions have some of the qualities of sensory deprivation tanks used for experimental purposes. At the limit, they approach the great social control institutions of the 18th and 19th centuries: asylums, workhouses, prisons, and reformatories. We have learned enough of such settings to know that, over time, they can produce among their inmates a characteristic institutional neurosis, marked by apathy, withdrawal, lack of initiative and spontaneity, uncommunicativeness, and intractability. The neurosis is an accommodation to a deprived, bland, monotonous, controlled environment that is ultimately stupefying. The point is simply that high modernist designs for life and production tend to diminish the skills, agility, initiative, and morale of their intended beneficiaries. They bring about a mild form of this institutional neurosis. Or, to put it in the utilitarian terms that many of their partisans would recognize, these designs tend to reduce the human capital of the workforce. Complex, diverse, animated environments contribute, as Jacobs saw, to producing a resilient, flexible, adept population that has more experience in confronting novel changes and taking initiative. Narrow, planned environments, by contrast, foster a less skilled, less innovative, less resourceful population. This population, once created, would ironically have been exactly the kind of human material that would in fact have needed close supervision from above. In other words, the logic of social engineering on this scale was to produce the sort of subjects that its plans had assumed at the outset. That authoritarian social engineering failed to create a world after its own image should not blind us to the fact that it did, at the very least, damage many of the earlier structures of mutuality and practice that were essential to meet us. The Soviet Kolkhoz hardly lived up to its expectations, but by treating its workforce more like factory hands than farmers, it did destroy many of the agricultural skills the peasantry had possessed on the eve of collectivization. Even if there was much in the earlier arrangements that ought to have been abolished, local tyrannies based on class, gender, age, and lineage, a certain institutional autonomy was abolished as well. Here, I believe, there is something to the classical anarchist claim that the state, with its positive law and central institutions, undermines individuals' capacities for autonomous self-governance, that might apply to the planning grids of high modernism as well. Their own institutional legacy may be frail and evanescent, but they may impoverish the local wellsprings of economic, social, and cultural self-expression. The failure of schematics and the role of Mises. Everything is said to be under the leadership of the party. No one is in charge of the crab or the fish, but they are all alive. Vietnamese villager, Xuân Huy Village. Not long after the decisive political opening in 1989 in what was then still the Soviet Union, a Congress of Agricultural Specialists was convened to consider reforms in agriculture. Most participants were in favor of breaking up the collectives and privatizing the land in the hope of recreating a modern version of the private sector that had thrived in the 1920s and that Stalin had destroyed in 1930. And yet they were nearly unanimous in their despair over what three generations had done to the skills, initiative, and knowledge of the Kolkhozniki. They compared their situation unfavorably to that of China, where a mere 25 years of collectivization had, they imagined, left much of the entrepreneurial skill of the peasantry intact. Suddenly a woman from Novosibirsk scolded them, "How do you think the rural people survived 60 years of collectivization in the first place? If they hadn't used their initiative and wits, they wouldn't have made it through. They may need credit and supplies, but there's nothing wrong with their initiative." Despite the manifold failures of collectivization, it seems the Kolkhozniki have found ways and means to at least get by. We should not forget in this context that the first response to collectivization in 1930 was determined resistance and even rebellion. Once that resistance was broken, the survivors had little choice but to comply outwardly. They could hardly make the rural command economy a success, but they could do what was necessary to meet minimal quotas and ensure their own economic survival. An indication of the kinds of improvisations both tolerated and required may be inferred from an astute case study of two East German factories before the wall came down in 1989. Each factory was under great pressure to meet production quotas on which their all-important bonuses depended, in spite of old machinery, inferior raw materials, and a lack of spare parts. Under these draconian conditions, two employees were indispensable to the firm, despite their modest place in the official hierarchy. One was the jack-of-all-trades who improvised short-term solutions to keep machinery running, to correct or disguise production flaws, and to make raw materials stretch further. The second was a wheeler-dealer who located and bought or bartered for spare parts, machinery, and raw material that could not be obtained through official channels in time. To facilitate the wheeler-dealer's work, the factory routinely used its funds to stock up on such valued non-perishable goods as soap powder, cosmetics, quality paper, yarn, good wine and champagne, medicines, and fashionable clothes. When it seemed that the plant would fall short of the quota because it lacked a key valve or machine tool, these knowledgeable dealers would set off across the country, their small Trabant autos jammed with barter goods, to secure what was needed. Neither of these roles was provided for in the official table of organization, and yet the survival of the factory depended more on their skills, wisdom, and experience than on those of any other employee. A key element in the centrally planned economy was underwritten, always unofficially, by Mises. Cases like the one just described are the rule, not the exception. They serve to illustrate that the formal order encoded in social engineering designs inevitably leaves out elements that are essential to their actual functioning. If the factory were forced to operate only within the confines of the roles and functions specified in the simplified design, it would quickly grind to a halt. Collectivized command economies virtually everywhere have limped along thanks to the often desperate improvisation of an informal economy wholly outside its schemata. Stated somewhat differently, all socially engineered systems of formal order are in fact subsystems of a larger system on which they are ultimately dependent, not to say parasitic. The subsystem relies on a variety of processes, frequently informal or antecedent, which alone it cannot create or maintain. The more schematic, thin, and simplified the formal order, the less resilient and the more vulnerable it is to disturbances outside its narrow parameters. This analysis of high modernism, then, may appear to be a case for the invisible hand of market coordination as opposed to centralized economies. An important caution, however, is in order. The market is itself an instituted formal system of coordination, despite the elbow room that it provides to its participants, and it is therefore similarly dependent on a larger system of social relations which its own calculus does not acknowledge, and which it can neither create nor maintain. Here I have in mind not only the obvious elements of contract and property law, as well as the state's coercive power to enforce them, but antecedent patterns and norms of social trust, community, and cooperation, without which market exchange is inconceivable. Finally, and most important, the economy is a subsystem of a finite and non-growing ecosystem whose carrying capacity and interactions it must respect as a condition of its persistence. It is, I think, a characteristic of large formal systems of coordination that they are accompanied by what appear to be anomalies, but on closer inspection, turn out to be integral to that formal order. Much of this might be termed Mises to the rescue, although for people ensnared in schemes of authoritarian social engineering that threaten to do them in, such improvisations bear the mark of scrambling and desperation. Many modern cities, and not just those in the Third World, function and survive by virtue of slums and squatter settlements, whose residents provide essential services. A formal command economy, as we have seen, is contingent on petty trade, bartering, and deals that are typically illegal. A formal economy of pension systems, social security, and medical benefits is underwritten by a mobile floating population with few of these protections. Similarly, hybrid crops and mechanized farm operations persist only because of the diversity and immunities of antecedent land races. In each case, the non-conforming practice is an indispensable condition for formal order. A case for Metis-friendly institutions. The invention of scientific forestry, freehold tenure, planned cities, collective farms, Ujamaa villages, and industrial agriculture, for all their ingeniousness, represented fairly simple interventions into enormously complex natural and social systems. After being abstracted from systems whose interactions defied a total accounting, a few elements were then made the basis for an imposed order. At best, the new order was fragile and vulnerable, sustained by improvisations not foreseen by its originators. At worst, it wreaked untold damage and shattered lives, a damaged ecosystem, and fractured or impoverished societies. This rather blanket condemnation must be tempered, especially in the case of social systems, by at least four considerations. First, and most important, the social orders they were designed to supplant were typically so manifestly unjust and oppressive that almost any new order might seem preferable. Second, high modernist social engineering usually came cloaked in egalitarian emancipatory ideas. Equality before the law, citizenship for all, and rights to subsistence, health, education, and shelter. The premise and great appeal of the high modernist credo was that the state would make the benefits of technological progress available to all its citizens. The two remaining reasons for tempering our condemnation of such schemes have less to do with their potentially destructive consequences than with the capacity of ordinary human actors to modify them, or in the end, to bring them down. Where functioning representative institutions were at hand, some accommodation was inevitable. In their absence, it is still remarkable how the dogged day-to-day resistance of thousands of citizens forced the abandonment or restructuring of projects. Given sufficient time and leeway, of course, any high modernist plan will be utterly remade by popular practice. Soviet collective farms, the most draconian case, were finally brought down as much by the dispirited work and resistance of the Kolkhozniki as by the political shifts in Moscow. Without denying the incontestable benefits either of the division of labor or of hierarchical coordination for some tasks, I want to make a case for institutions that are instead multifunctional, plastic, diverse, and adaptable. In other words, institutions that are powerfully shaped by Metis. The fact that those ensnared in confining systems of formal order seem constantly to be working in their own interest to make the systems more versatile is one indication of a common process of social domestication. A second indication is the social magnetism of autonomy and diversity, as seen, for example, in the popularity of Jacobs's mixed-use neighborhoods and in the continued attraction of self-employment. Diversity and certain forms of complexity, apart from their attractiveness, have other advantages. In natural systems, we know these advantages are manifold. Old-growth forests, polycropping, and agriculture with open-pollinated land races may not be as productive, in the short run, as single-species forests and fields or identical hybrids, but they are demonstrably more stable, more self-sufficient, and less vulnerable to epidemics and environmental stress, needing far less in the way of external infusions to keep them on track. Every time we replace natural capital, such as wild fish stocks or old-growth forests, with what might be called cultivated natural capital, such as fish farms or tree plantations, we gain in ease of appropriation and in immediate productivity, but at the cost of more maintenance expenses and less redundancy, resiliency, and stability. If the environmental challenges faced by such systems are both modest and predictable, then a certain simplification might also be relatively stable. Other things being equal, however, the less diverse the cultivated natural capital, the more vulnerable and non-sustainable it becomes. The problem is that in most economic systems, the external costs, in water or air pollution, for example, or the exhaustion of non-renewable resources, including a reduction in biodiversity, accumulate long before the activity becomes unprofitable in a narrow profit and loss sense. A roughly similar case can be made, I think, for human institutions, a case that contrasts the fragility of rigid single-purpose centralized institutions to the adaptability of more flexible, multi-purpose, decentralized social forms. As long as the task environment of an institution remains repetitive, stable, and predictable, a set of fixed routines may prove exceptionally efficient. In most economies, and in human affairs generally, this is seldom the case, and such routines are likely to be counterproductive once the environment changes appreciably. The long-term survival of certain human institutions, the family, the small community, the small farm, the family firm in certain businesses, is something of a tribute to their adaptability under radically changing circumstances. They are by no means infinitely adaptable, but they have weathered more than one prediction of their inevitable demise. The small family farm, by virtue of its flexible labor, including the exploitation of its children, its capacity to shift into new crops or livestock, and its tendency to diversify its risks, has managed to persist in competitive economies when many huge, highly leveraged, mechanized, and specialized corporate and state farms have failed. In a sector of the economy where local knowledge, quick responses to weather and crop conditions, and low overhead, smallness, are more important than in, say, large industry, the family farm has some formidable advantages. Even in huge organizations, diversity pays dividends in stability and resilience. A one-product city like the Stalinist steelmaking jewel Magnitogorsk is vulnerable when its technology is superseded and more specialty products are required, whereas a non-specialized city with a host of industries and a diverse labor force can weather greater shocks. Within the most industrialized economies, it is still striking that complex and often low-income subsistence strategies, self-provisioning and working off the books, are both widespread and essential, although they are nearly invisible in most forms of economic accounting. Much has also been made of the rather complex family firms in Emilia-Romagna, Italy, which have thrived for generations in an extremely competitive world textile market by virtue of networks of mutuality, adaptability, and a highly skilled and committed workforce. The family firms are at the same time embedded in a much-studied local society that is several centuries deep in associational life and civic skills. These firms, and the dense, diverse societies upon which they depend, have increasingly seemed less like archaic survivals and more like forms of enterprise ideally suited to post-industrial capitalism. Even within the narrow confines of market competitiveness in liberal industrial societies, the case for polyvalent, adaptive small units is stronger than any high modernist of the 1920s could possibly have imagined. Once we measure such polyvalent institutions by broader criteria, moreover, the case becomes even more powerful. Much of the argument at this level comes back to the question posed earlier. What kind of person does this sort of institution foster? No one has established the link between economic enterprise and political skills better than Thomas Jefferson in his celebration of the yeoman farmer. The autonomy and the skills required in independent farming, Jefferson believed, helped to nurture a citizen with a habit of responsible decision-making, enough property to avoid social dependence, and a tradition of reasoning and negotiation with his fellow citizens. The yeomanry was, in short, an ideal training ground for democratic citizenship. To any planned, built, or legislated form of social life, one may apply a comparable test. To what degree does it promise to enhance the skills, knowledge, and responsibility of those who are a part of it? On narrower institutional grounds, the question would be how deeply that form is marked by the values and experience of those who compose it. The purpose in each case would be to distinguish canned situations that permit little or no modification from situations largely open to the development and application of metis. A brief example comparing war memorials may be helpful. The Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C. is surely one of the most successful war memorials ever built, if one is to judge by the quantity and intensity of the visits it receives. Designed by Maya Lin, the memorial consists simply of a gently undulating site, marked, not dominated, by a long, low black marble wall listing the names of the fallen. The names are listed neither alphabetically nor by military unit, but chronologically, in the order in which they fell, thus grouping those who had fallen on the same day in the same engagement. No larger claim is made about the war, either in prose or in sculpture, which is hardly surprising in view of the stark political cleavages the war still inspires. What is most remarkable, however, is the way that the Vietnam Memorial works for those who visit it, particularly those who come to pay their respects to the memory of a comrade or loved one. They touch the names incised on the wall, make rubbings, and leave artifacts and mementos of their own. Everything from poems and a woman's high-heeled shoe to a glass of champagne and the poker hand of a full house aces high. So many of these tributes have been left, in fact, that a museum has been created to house them. The scene of many people together at the wall, touching the names of particular loved ones who fell in the same war, has moved observers regardless of their position on the war itself. I believe that a great part of the memorial's symbolic power is its capacity to honor the dead with an openness that allows visitors to impress upon it their own meanings, their own histories, their own memories. The memorial virtually requires participation in order to complete its meaning. Although one would not compare it to a Rorschach test, the memorial nevertheless does achieve its meaning as much by what citizens bring to it as by what it imposes. Compare the Vietnam Memorial to a very different American War Memorial. The sculpture depicting the raising of the American flag at the summit of Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima in World War II. Moving in its own right, referring as it does to the final moment of a victory gained at an enormous cost in lives, the Iwo Jima statue is manifestly heroic. Its patriotism, symbolized by the flag, its reference to conquest, its larger-than-life scale, and its implicit theme of unity and victory, leave little room for wondering what is expected from the viewer. Given the virtual unanimity with which that war was and is viewed in the United States, it is hardly surprising that the Iwo Jima Memorial should be monumental and explicit about its message. Although not exactly canned, the Iwo Jima site is more symbolically self-sufficient, as are most war memorials. Visitors can stand in awe, gazing on an image that through photographs and sculpture has become a virtual icon for the war in the Pacific, but they receive its message rather than completing it. An institution, social form, or enterprise that takes much of its shape from the evolving mitos of the people engaged in it will thereby enhance their range of experience and skills. Following the advice of the saying, use it or lose it, the mitos-friendly institution both uses and renews a valuable public good. As an exclusive litmus test for all social forms, this is clearly insufficient. All social forms are artificially constructed to serve some human purpose. Where that purpose is narrow, simple, and invariable over time, it may well be that codified hierarchical routines are adequate and possibly the most efficient in the short run. Even in such cases, however, we should be aware of the human costs of stultifying routines and the likely resistance to rote performance. Whenever, on the contrary, the quality of the institution and its product depends on engaging the enthusiastic participation of its people, then such a litmus test makes sense. In the case of housing, for example, its success cannot be severed from the opinions of its users. Housing planners that take as a given the variety of human tastes and the inevitable but unpredictable changes in the shape of families will accommodate that variation from the outset by providing flexible building designs and adjustable floor plans. Developers of neighborhoods, by the same token, will promote the sort of diversity and complexity that will help to ensure their vitality and durability. Above all, those with planning and zoning powers will not see their task as one of making sure that neighborhoods hold, through thick and thin, to their designed forms. One can imagine many types of institutions, schools, parks, playgrounds, civic associations, business enterprises, families, even planning bodies, that might well be evaluated through the same lens. A good many institutions in liberal democracies already take such a form and may serve as exemplars for fashioning new ones. One could say that democracy itself is based on the assumption that the metis of its citizenry should, in mediated form, continually modify the laws and policies of the land. Common law, as an institution, owes its longevity to the fact that it is not a final codification of legal rules, but rather a set of procedures for continually adapting some broad principles to novel circumstances. Finally, that most characteristic of human institutions, language, is the best model. A structure of meaning and continuity that is never still and ever open to the improvisations of all its speakers. This concludes the reading of Seeing Like a State, How Certain Schemes to Improve the Human Condition Have Failed, by James C. Scott. Copyright 1998 by Yale University. This is a book in the Yale Agrarian Studies series, James C. Scott Series Editor. This book was read by Michael Kramer. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Yale University on behalf of Yale University Press and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.